From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore the State of Working Wisconsin report, which found declining unemployment and rising wages. Then, the president of the Service Employees International Union shares why they're encouraging Wisconsinites to get out and vote.
We are spending our time making sure we touch every corner of battleground states where we want to make sure people know that this election is about them too.
Plus, we'll tell you about We Are Big Time, a new graphic novel based on an all-Muslim girls basketball team at a Milwaukee school.
They, you know, really wanted to just play basketball, and suddenly it became much bigger than that. So that was something I wanted to explore as well and dig beyond maybe what you could see in the headlines.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The economy and inflation have been top issues in this presidential election year. But a new report suggests that Wisconsin workers are doing relatively well and even exceeding expectations despite inflation. The report released by the High Road Strategy Center at UW-Madison found rising wages and declining unemployment in Wisconsin. Laura Dresser is the associate director of the center, and Troy Brewer is a lead cook and union steward at the Pfizer Forum. They join Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the State of Working Wisconsin report.
Laura, I'm going to say, per your report, the State of Working Wisconsin does seem to be pretty good with some caveats. What is the overall picture looking like? And let's start with unemployment numbers and new job creation.
Yeah, the labor market is strong in the sense that we've produced a lot of jobs, 25,000 jobs over the past year, more today than in the past, a record high number of jobs in this state. The unemployment rate has stayed low, near or under 3% for the last year. So that's good unemployment number. And that, I think it's important to see the ways that that helps workers demand more from work. When the unemployment rate is low, people who are in jobs know that they're less easy to replace, and it means they can demand more of work. And we see that in the wage trends, where it's the low-wage workers that have made the most significant gains.
I was about to say, that does seem to speak to what we've seen in wage growth. What has that looked like over the past few years?
Since 2019, workers' wages at the median have grown faster than inflation. And I know that surprises some folks because the inflation in 2022 definitely was very intense, but workers' wages are going up faster than inflation. I think the interesting thing that we show in this report is that if you look from 2019 to the most recent data on wages, which is for 2023, in that period, the median workers' wages increase about 4% over the rate of inflation. And a worker who sits at the 20th percentile of the workforce, so 20% of workers earn less and 80% of workers earn more, that worker, the increase for the worker at the 20th percentile, their wages are up twice as fast as the median worker, up 8%. The disparity between the median worker and the low-wage worker is still huge, right? And the low-wage jobs still don't pay enough to get by. But the gap between the middle and the bottom of the labor market has closed over the last 5 years. And that's another place where we see the strength of this labor market. That doesn't mean there's no disparities. It doesn't mean there's no problems. But it does mean that in relative terms, if you want to kind of get something out of the labor market, you want to be in a labor market where unemployment is low and your ability to bargain for things is higher.
Now, Troy, you have real experience in this arena. You talked about your experience working minimum wage jobs. Can you tell us a bit about what that's been like in your own experience here in Wisconsin?
So I've worked in restaurants, fast foods, hotels, kitchens, without them being unionized. I started making $3.45 when I started working, and I've been in this for probably over 35 years. And now with the union job, I've surpassed all of that, but I would go 4 or 5 years with a quarter raise, or sometimes not a raise at all, or them just saying they didn't have it. And it was rough. I had to work 3-4 jobs at a time just to provide for my family food, shelter, clothing, things like that. So I missed out on a lot with my children as far as schools, plays, basketball, soccer games, all of that type of stuff. I would just kiss them in the morning, kiss them goodnight, and I'd be at work most of the time to try to make ends meet.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you work with the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Union. And we'll get to what this report actually says about unions in just a moment. But how has that changed your experience continuing to do the kind of work that you do? Because you are still working in the kitchen, right?
Yes. So working with MASH has changed my life completely. I never was allowed at that type of stuff, doing the type of work that I do. So unions have never been a part of it, and it was all new to me. And quite frankly, I dodged it for a while. Like, what can they really do for me? This isn't in my realm. And I went to one meeting. They hounded me. And now here I am 6 years later, praising what unions can do and what they can do for people. And the billion-dollar corporations and the people that make money off of you, they really don't care about you as a person. It's more so like the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And with the union stuff, it balances out the power to make us even have a seat at the table. You know, they always just sweep stuff under the rug, or you get the crumbs that fall on the floor, and they just continue to grow. And I think MASH has a wonderful platform. I think that we have the blueprint. I mean, it's not just food service that our thing can work for. It could be janitorial. It could be people that clean rooms in hotels. It could be healthcare workers. I mean, if it works down in a Deer District, it could work throughout the whole city.
Yeah. Now, MASH is its own kind of new union. But what this report found is that union interest, it seems, across the board is growing, while union participation itself is declining. Can you, Laura, talk a bit about what the report found?
Yeah. National data just sort of on impressions about unions has returned to the kind of positivity that we haven't seen since the mid-1960s. And if you look at younger workers, their positivity about unions is in the 80-85% of younger workers really feel good about the idea of unions. The problem is they don't really have access to them. The structure of national labor law is such that it's very hard to go from wanting a union to organizing your union to getting your contract and maintaining your union. And that's the work that MASH is doing every day, that Troy is doing every day, to keep workers engaged at that work site. But they had the benefit of an employer that was willing to agree to card check neutrality, that said, if you demonstrate that people want to be in a union, we'll move to bargaining a contract with them. You know, in other work sites, you face a lot of anti-union kind of union busting approaches by employers. And in the state of Wisconsin, especially, we have public sector and private sector labor law tipping heavily against unions as well. It means that it's a very uphill battle for unions to represent workers, even though workers report that they're interested in it.
Yeah. Now, Troy, you worked a long time without the union. You've had the last 6 years with the union. How would you characterize the way that your life has changed? You know, are you still missing out on aspects of your family's life that you had to previously?
So it's changed economically almost trifold than what I was making in a non-union job. We were a part of the community benefits agreement with the city of Milwaukee for the stadium to even be built, and it would be union and good living wage jobs. We were supposed to be at $15 an hour at the beginning of 2023. We are well above that. Nobody in the Pfizer form makes under $16.45. And with some of the tip pools and the things that people do in the building, most people are over $20 an hour. I mean, it's great, but to me, that's like the bottom ceiling of the living wage. Minimum wage should be that. Wisconsin is one of a few handful of states that hasn't done anything on that in a long time. We had a sit down with Senator Tammy Baldwin the other day at the Pfizer Forum. We just discussed different things and platforms and things like that. But this union job has tripled my pay as opposed to what it was without a union. And I've actually been able to cut down, and I'm only working at the Pfizer Forum and for MASH instead of working two or three jobs and having time to spend with my family.
That's great. As you mentioned, Troy, there's a lot of policies that could be changed, that could be maybe fixed. The minimum wage is still incredibly low in the state of Wisconsin. Laura, as you're looking at this report in the future, what are the policies that could be improved to help workers?
One thing we need to see is a much stronger floor under our labor market. And I think this has two aspects. One is dramatically raising the minimum wage in the state right now at $7.25 an hour, which is the federal level, and only 19 other states are stuck, like Wisconsin, at the federal minimum. Other states have just taken the federal inaction as a kind of reason to take some action at the state level. And we need to do that. Illinois is already at 13 for their floor, Michigan and Minnesota well over $10 an hour for their floors. Like Troy, you know, 15 or even 20 at this point is becoming more important or more relevant. But raising that standard under the labor market matters a lot. And enforcing it the way that we make sure that workers are actually paid. So too many workers not only face these low wages, but also the theft of wages by their bosses through either outright refusal to pay, mismarking of hours on timesheets systematically, things like that. So strong enforcement of the labor standard also really matters to keeping the labor market strong. And then also changing these state policy choices around unionization. We need federal labor law reform, but we also need Wisconsin labor law reform relating to public sector workers and to private sector workers so that workers can have the representation they want.
Sure. Well, Laura, Troy, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks for having me.
Really nice to be here.
Laura Dresser is the Associate Director of the High Road Strategy Center at UW-Madison, and Troy Brewer is a lead cook and union steward for MASH at the Pfizer Forum. They both join Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the State of Working Wisconsin report. Get Out the Vote efforts are underway in Wisconsin. One of the largest efforts is being run by the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, which represents 7,000 workers in the state. The union's international president, April Verrett, spoke last weekend at a pre-canvassing rally at the Milwaukee Area Technical College. WUWM's Chuck Kornbach was there and spoke with Verrett about why the union is endorsing Kamala Harris and why they want to make sure people in Wisconsin vote.
Just like in most national elections, Wisconsin is one of the epicenters of our fight for our future. And we know that Wisconsin is an important part of making sure we elect not just Kamala Harris to be the next president of this country and Tim Walz to be the next vice president, but what happens in Wisconsin has ramifications for the entire country. Just as we saw in 2011, what happened with Act 10 spread to other parts of the country. Other things that can happen here in Wisconsin can also have similar ramifications. So we want to make sure we keep Wisconsin on a path to being a state where working people have the opportunity to not just survive, but to thrive.
You've mentioned Kamala Harris and your union has already endorsed her. Can you give a sort of a thumbnail assessment as to why you support the Harris-Walz ticket?
Yeah. You know, Vice President Harris has always been all in for our members, and so we are proud to be all in for her. From the time she was a district attorney in San Francisco, as attorney general in the state of California, at the a U.S. senator for California. I was also a leader in California representing our long-term care workers in the state. And she has always stood up for us, whether it is going down to the border to meet with families impacted by a broken immigration system, whether it's standing up against big banks for working families and taking on, you know, predatory loans and mortgages, fighting against wage theft. whatever role she's played, she has always stood on the side of working people. She wasn't just a McDonald's, you know, employee at one time in her life. She's walked the picket line with fast food workers. She's walked the day in the shoes of home care workers and security officers. Like we hear her talk about, she's from a middle class family. She knows what it means to watch her mother, you know, sit at the kitchen table and worrying about making ends meet. And that resonates with our members and with working people all over the country. That's why she is the best choice to be the next president of this country.
And former President Trump, he has his supporters here. It's a battleground state. Polls show things are very close. Your thumbnail assessment of Donald Trump?
There's no doubt a lot of people are going to vote for Donald Trump, not just here in Wisconsin, but across the country. But I believe that he talks good talk, but the proof is in the policies. The proof is the impact that his presidency had on working people, his abandonment of essential workers, not making sure they had protective equipment during the pandemic. Right. Policies that and appointments to appoint some of the worst actors in the National Labor Relations Board, gutting the funding for the National Labor Relations Board. Right. That just flies in the face of what working people know we need and want. You know, joking with Elon Musk about firing striking workers. Right. That's not who America is. That's not he's not the president that America deserves.
Now, he says some of the rank-and-file union members around the country, not just SEIU, but other unions, like him because of his views on holding down inflation, securing, as he says, the border. What's your reaction? Is he having any success in splitting the union movement?
You know, sure, there are going to be some union members that vote for him. But working people are going to make a difference in this election. Working people that are energized by the vision for a future that we've heard Vice President Harris and Governor Walz talk about. I am more certain than ever that more union members are going to side on the side of progress and don't want to go back, right, to what we know another presidency from President Trump will bring us, right? Working people want a future where we can't just, you know, struggle to make ends meet. We want a future where we can all have the opportunity to thrive.
The Teamsters Union, the council in 39 in Wisconsin, said it would be reaching out to its members in the coming weeks. Is that part of your effort, not just to reach out to the general public, but also reaching out to more SEIU members?
Well, I can't necessarily speak to what the Teamsters are doing, but I know what SEIU members are doing all across this country. We have a goal nationally to reach more than 6 million voters across the country, not just SEIU members, but voters who most folks in their campaigning don't reach out to. I call them high opportunity voters, right? Some people refer to them as low propensity or infrequent voters. I'm talking about people of color, first-time voters, young people, folks who English isn't their first language, right? So navigating the election process isn't so easy. So we are spending our time making sure we touch every corner of battleground states where we want to make sure people know that this election is about them too. And that's what we are busy doing. We're busy reaching our goal of reaching 800,000 voters in the state of Wisconsin.
You were saying in your recent talk at MATC in Milwaukee that in some ways, what's happening on November 5th is bigger than the election. Is that your goal is even bigger than the election? What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I fundamentally believe elections can't just be about Election Day, right? We can't just do all of this work from Labor Day, many of us, to Election Day, spend all of this money, and only care about the outcome of the election. Policy matters. Moving an agenda forward matters. And so we aren't just investing in voters. We are investing in citizens. We are investing in people who want to be participants in this democracy to make sure we are working together to create a country that we all want and deserve.
Part of your outreach that the SEIU is doing, and I'm hearing from other unions in Wisconsin, ties into the Act 10 law passed 12 years ago or so, led by Republican Governor Scott Walker. Tie in the Act 10 status, which is being challenged in the courts, to this fall's election.
Yeah, what we saw happen here in Wisconsin in 2011, right, with the movement of Act 10, it was a part of what has been a 40-year attack on working people and unions in this country. We know that when workers have power, when unions have power, corporations don't have as much power. And so they've waged this attack to diminish the power of unions so that they can do things like we're seeing them do today. Price gouge, right? It's a travesty that Americans are going to grocery stores every single day wondering how in the world they're going to have enough money to feed their families. And so this election is about that, but it's also about who has power. Right? And can working people have enough power to be able to push back on unfair policies, systems that are rigged against us? And so Act 10 is just an example of how power has been taken away from working people. But we're seeing workers stand up all over this country, right? Nurses here in the University of Wisconsin system, whose union was taken away from them, haven't stopped fighting. And so November 5th is about that fight, and it's about fights like that that's happening all over the country, from Waffle House workers in the South, you know, moving against Waffle House, against wage theft. We saw auto workers, right, earlier this year take to the strike line. All of those fights come together to be about worker power, building an unprecedented amount of working power so that working people can take on the big stuff in our country.
Just for balance, I do need to ask, the Republicans say that inflation is... A lot of it is due to spending, too much spending by the federal government, the Inflation Reduction Act, ARPA, et cetera. What do you think?
I think that, you know, they try to make that claim, and yet they go cut ribbons and they go to all of these openings of bridge constructions all over their district, taking the credit for it, right? I think they speak out of both sides of their mouth, and they know the truth, right? That they have been a part of systematically taking power away and giving more power to the corporations that line their political coffers, and that they can do the work of making sure corporations cannot continue to exploit working people.
Finally, you're the first Black woman to head the SEIU National Presidency. How does that change things for the union? Does it make a difference? If so, how might the issues be different that you address?
Well, I believe that no matter what the color of my skin is, I am a leader of a union that wants to build power for everyone. But the reality is that opportunity for people like me to lead has been limited, right? Not just in the union movement in this country, but, you know, just look at the fact that today there is one Black woman sitting in the United States Senate. And, you know, I always say the real flex is not being the first. The real flex is making sure that I'm not the last. And so as president of our union, I'm making sure we create more opportunity for all of us to be able to reach our highest potential and to lead. And sometimes that means centering those of us that have been the most marginalized. Women, people of color, right? And so this is about building more accessibility to leadership and to opportunity for all of us, right? We want everyone to be included, no one to be left out.
April Verrett is the president of SEIU. She spoke with WUWM's Chuck Kornbach at a rally this past weekend. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 20 minutes, we'll tell you about Unseen, a documentary showing during Milwaukee Film's Dialogues Documentary Festival this week. But first, we'll speak with an author who wrote a children's book based on an all-Muslim girls basketball team from Milwaukee. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We Are Big Time is a new graphic novel by children's author Henna Khan. It's inspired by the all-Muslim hijab-wearing girls basketball team of the Salaam School here in Milwaukee. The story follows a Muslim teen who comes to Wisconsin from Florida, and while faced with new experiences, joins a basketball team struggling to find its footing on the court. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell is joined by Khan to learn why she was inspired by the Salaam School team.
This is a fictionalized story of the epic Salaam School Girls 2018 to 2019 season, where they really had this amazing turnaround from, you know, being a struggling team to getting to the playoffs and all that involved. I actually learned of the team and saw some of the coverage they had received and was so inspired. I wanted to tell a fictionalized version of a girl named Aaliyah, who sort of is a composite of different players I had the chance to speak to, and goes through some of the same struggles that they went through, but also some of the wonderful joys of being part of this amazing team and this really inspiring season.
Yeah, and I'm sure a few of our listeners probably remember the last couple of years, the team being in, you know, local and national news. So when you were writing this book, what were you thinking about and what message were you trying to convey?
Yeah, well, so for me, it was a very different type of writing because this was my first graphic novel. And for me, it was really important to write it in that format because of the powerful imagery, seeing these girls in their uniforms with their hijabs, following the action in a very visual way, you know, I thought was a nice way to get the story across. So it was a different type of writing for me, but I was thinking about the inspiration of these girls, but also, you know, the typical, very relatable challenges of being a student athlete and some of the things that involves, things like moving and being in a new school and needing to make new friends and all the things that kids today face, along with the joys of being part of this team and the wonderful season they had. But another key point I wanted to include and was thinking about while I was researching and writing was the unexpected media attention that these girls got and the sudden, I guess, expectation that they were representing their faith and other, you know, hijab wearing women around the world, and that intense pressure and scrutiny that they were suddenly under, where they, you know, really wanted to just play basketball and suddenly they were, it became much bigger than that. So that was something I wanted to explore as well and dig beyond maybe what you could see in the headlines and the stories that were out there, but really ask the girls, what did it feel like to be under that kind of pressure? And what do you wish people had asked you? And I wanted to weave that aspect of their experience into the story as well.
I'm curious, what were some of the things that they had to say?
So, I mean, a lot of it was just about what it was like to be part of the team and some of their specific experiences around being a player, what position, you know, the expectations they put on themselves, for example, in terms of performing well, balancing schoolwork and all the other pressures of high school. But when it came to the media part in particular, one thing that was interesting is I kept digging and asking for more, because from the way some of the coverage was presented, it made it sound like they were overcoming stereotypes and discrimination. I said, well, did something happen? Because there was like sort of an allusion to incidents. And I thought maybe there was something dramatic that had happened or some racist incident that, you know, was part of their experience. And thankfully, it sounds like it wasn't. I mean, they did feel that people perhaps judged them outwardly and maybe didn't take them seriously as basketball players initially when they would walk into the room, or, you know, they said we sometimes felt like they were laughing at us or, you know, thought they would get an easy win. But a lot of it came down to typical basketball trash talking, you know, wasn't necessarily directed at their identity, which to me was a relief, but something I feel like, you know, I wanted to include as well, that it wasn't all negative. A lot of it was very positive for them.
That's good to hear.
And I think for them, I mean, what was really fun for me to discover and read about was the way they started and how it was this ragtag team that didn't have a lot of, you know, professional level coaching. And when Coach Cass came in and really made them work very hard, but, you know, in a very directed way and building up their skills, it made this huge difference. And I think that was also what was so appealing about the story, is that it has that feel good turnaround sports story that we all love to follow and support. And I can see why it was so appealing and inspiring all around, on top of the fact that these girls were unique in terms of how they presented themselves. So that was really fun to explore as well.
Nice. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to say, like, what was the best part for you about writing this book? So I want to just ask more generally about the work that you do in writing children's books. Just like why that demographic? What do you enjoy most about writing children's books?
Yeah, so I think for me, it goes back to being a kid myself and the way I felt I connected to books as a young person and the way they really spoke to me and opened up my eyes to the world around me and the way other people lived. I grew up as a child of immigrants and as a Muslim, didn't feel like I always fit in. So I think books really filled that curiosity that I had for, people around me. And really were a source of comfort and a source of friendship, really made me a lot less lonely as a child, I think. I found a lot of solace in the characters I read. And I felt like they helped shape me as a person in many ways. I still think about those characters that I read and the stories that I encountered as a kid. And that makes me really want to write for children in the hopes that my stories will stay with kids. But I also think that writing for children is also writing for adults because we have adults, who are teachers, who are librarians, parents who read with their children. So even though these stories are technically written for children, I like to think that they truly are for everyone. And I always encourage adults to read books that center young characters because it's still good storytelling. It's just from the perspective of a younger person rather than an adult.
I feel like it speaks to our inner child, right? Even as an adult picking up those books.
Absolutely. And we see that in, children's books. I know at least my characters, a lot of times they're grappling with the same things I worry about as an adult. Things like, are these people really my friends? Or or how do I deal with social media and the pressure of that, or feelings of anxiety, or whatever it is that we don't outgrow, and a lot of those challenges stay with us our whole lives. So it's hopefully universally relevant.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And you talked about how just reading books as a kid, it opened your eyes to the people around you. And that leads me to my next question, which was, we're in this time where a lot of books, particularly those by like diverse voices, diverse stories, they're being banned, right? Being put on the back shelves and the kids don't have access to them. And it's because folks in power, people who just don't, they consider diverse perspectives divisive, right? That's kind of the result of that. And so when you talk about the impact that reading books as a child had on you and that it's, still relevant to you today. If you're talking to a parent about why they should pick up We Are Big Time for their kids, what would you say to them?
Yeah, I think it's so unfortunate to see what's happening in the industry and in society with book banning, sort of being a bigger problem than it was years ago. And some of my books are included on lists of banned books because they've been included on lists for anti-racist education or for inclusive learning. And it breaks my heart to know that kids are being denied access to these stories that will help them to get to know people around them who may look different than them, to get to know their families, to see how much they have in common with these characters and their lives, rather than them being threatening or problematic in any way. These books build empathy, they build, understanding, really. And the fact that stories by BIPOC creators and others are being pulled from shelves for no good reason other than that they are featuring, characters that aren't traditionally seen in the mainstream, which is why we've all pushed to have these books included for the past 20 years. And there, we've seen things change slowly for the better in terms of inclusivity. And to now see that pendulum swing back the other way, where people are finding these books threatening, is so tragic to me. Because I've seen the impact, and I've visited schools across the country in big cities and rural towns, and I've talked to kids of all backgrounds, and they connect with these stories and they learn a lot, and they tell me the most amazing things about how they feel about the characters or how they saw themselves in my stories, even if they're completely different than my characters. And that's what I love about books as, overall, in terms of opening our eyes to new experiences and to new people. And I really hope that people will read widely and push back against this banning that's occurring and say, not in my community, not in my home. I will let my children read widely and read freely and get to know the world and society as it exists, rather than keeping them in a little bubble of people who only look like them.
And especially when you have the stories of kids who are like what the impact was on them. Like, you see that face to face. Just listen to the kids, right?
Yeah. And one of the popular misconceptions is that diverse books are only for, you know, the children being represented in that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, that's never been my objective. You asked earlier about, you know, what message I have or what my motive is. And really, that's always been my goal, is to have to center Muslim and Pakistani American characters who look like me and my children, but for them to not only be the protagonists that other kids like us can see themselves and feel included in, but also so that they can be seen, you know, that yeah. others can see them as the heroes of these stories. And accept that, just like I accepted Ramona Quimby and, you know, Harriet the Spy and everyone else. And it never occurred to me that, oh, these children don't look exactly like me, or their families aren't exactly like mine. I love those characters. I rooted for those characters. And that's what I feel like we should encourage our kids to do across the board for all types of characters.
I want to allow you to share any final thoughts you might have.
Yeah, sure. Well, it was really fun to get to write another book set in Milwaukee. My first novel, Amina's Voice, and the sequel, Amina's Song, were actually set here as well, because my husband grew up in the area and his family still lives here. So I have ties. I have family of my own now living here as well. So it feels like a second home to me. And it was fun to be able to include Milwaukee history and Milwaukee landmarks like Cops Frozen Custard and other things in the book. And it's nice for me to see the enthusiasm of other people around the, you know, country when they say, wow, Milwaukee rap, like, I can't wait to read this. And I hope you all will. And I hope you'll tell me what you think about it as an author. I know people have mixed feelings about reading reviews, but I love hearing from readers and those who tell me what they thought about my books. And it's always important to me to connect with readers. So please do connect. You can find me on social media and through my website. But I hope you will read and read widely and check out my other books too. And thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Henna Khan is the author of We Are Big Time. She spoke with WUWM's Taryn Powell. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then we'll speak with the director of the documentary Unseen, that follows the life of a blind, undocumented immigrant in America. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most people dream of a better future, and Pedro, an aspiring social worker, is no different. However, as a blind, undocumented immigrant, he faces obstacles to get his college degree, secure a job, and support his family. Pedro's story is the focus of the documentary Unseen. Through experimental cinematography and sound, the documentary reimagines accessibility in cinema while exploring the intersections of immigration, disability, and mental health. The film will be screening during Milwaukee Film's Dialogues Documentary Festival, and ahead of that, I'm joined by Unseen's director and producer, Set Hernandez. Set, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me, Audrey. So privileged to be here.
Now, I want to start talking about the opening sequence and how it truly sets the audience up in one of the most unique ways I've experienced. And it begins with the film. It's a bit bright, the picture's blurred, and your brain kind of automatically waits for it to focus, right? But then it doesn't. So can you share a bit more on how you decided to set the tone and keep it this way? Had you seen this technique done before?
For the most part, I was making the film because I wanted Pedro to be able to enjoy the film, not in a lesser way than anybody that's sighted, for example, but because the story is about Pedro, I wanted Pedro to feel like this film is about him. But because film is often perceived as a primarily visual medium, How can we subvert that and invite people to watch a film by listening, which is often how Pedro experiences film through audio description? And if you're a sighted viewer, how do we invite you then to also listen to the film? So the intention for the blurred visuals throughout the film, which is set up in the first scene, is actually a desire to imagine what equitable enjoyment, for lack of better words, of cinema would be like, where blind viewers and sighted viewers, even though they will never experience films the same way, there's an intention that one wouldn't enjoy the film more than the other audience. And I think it's a dynamic that we're continuing to explore in our film and in cinema. And a mentor of mine, Christy Tully, shared with me this tactic where you can film without putting a lens on the camera. In essence, we got these techniques of blurred visuals by putting a gaffer's tape over the aperture of the camera, poking a hole on it, just so that the camera can capture shapes, lights, and silhouettes, in essence. But there's no way to really focus the image because there's no lens on the camera. So all this to say, Audrey, the intention for the blurred visuals of the cinematography is not so much to simulate blindness, because I think to a certain extent that's quite unethical as a non-blind person myself, but rather to invite people to experience watching a movie in a different way.
With Pedro and your relationship, as you mentioned, it's kind of a young coming of age story. How did you first meet him, and what was it about him that compelled you to start filming?
So Pedro and I met when I was helping to coordinate a program for young undocumented adults. And when I say the word young, I just kind of chuckle in my head because it took so long to make the film that we're no longer young ourselves. But at the time in 2015, when we met, there were very few, and maybe to this day still, you know, very few opportunities for undocumented young professionals to use their skill sets in a way that is congruent with the education, for example, that they've received. So that year I was one of the coordinators, and Pedro happens to be one of the fellows, one of the participants. But what I noticed that was very unique about Pedro that morning that I met him is that he had a dog. And I realized that Pedro's dog was his guide dog, Tyler. And I think at that moment, I recognized that we don't often talk about disabled, undocumented immigrants within our movements. And that was pretty much the impetus to explore. Having been an organizer myself for a while, you know, by then, I wanted to make sure to find a way to lift up Pedro's story as an undocumented blind person. But in the course of the 6-7 years we've made the film actually wasn't just about that. And actually, maybe more than just that.
Right. I mean, there's a lot to explore in this film, a lot of big themes, a lot of interpersonal struggles and insights, you know, as you mentioned, such as the intersections of immigration, disability, and mental health, and plenty more. And within all of this, there's that underlying question that Pedro mentions of, you know, who is deserving, and the tendency to romanticize struggle. And I'm wondering for you as a filmmaker, and obviously this was such a long process, but did you have any difficulty as a filmmaker in making sure you didn't frame this film in a way that would romanticize Pedro's story in a way that didn't serve him? You know, I'm curious about what your guiding principles were.
Okay, Audrey, I love a good question. Super juicy and hearty. Thank you so much for your perceptiveness around this. Because, like, for example, the last few weeks especially, or maybe just the last few years, immigration, you know, has been a topic in the news in all the wrong reasons, maybe even. And at the same time, also the experiences of blind people in particular and disabled people are not often as lifted up in the news cycle. There's like almost like this imbalance in terms of Pedro's two identities and how those are reflected in the everyday media that we consume or experience. And I think when I was making the film, from the very get-go, I told Pedro, when the film comes out and you get to experience it, I want you to be able to tell me, Seth, you understand who I am. You made a film that's literally about me. But to be able to do that, I wanted to make sure that Pedro is actually represented in the way that he understands himself. Because often I think portrayals of immigration and disability in the media, particularly blindness, is through the lens of non-disabled filmmakers, non-immigrant filmmakers, for audiences that are not from our community also. Because as an undocumented person myself, actually, I think part of the intention why I wanted to make the film is I've watched so many movies about immigration, but I'm convinced that most of those movies, if not all of them, are portrayals of our community for the gaze, the proverbial gaze of citizens. And the reason I get that sense is because they're often through the perspective of deprivation, trauma, you know, and how deprived our lives are, how sad we are, how deserving we are of pity, you know. And I think for me, I wanted to make a film where undocumented immigrants and people with disabilities, particularly blind people, are thought of as the primary audiences for film, where we're creating a movie that speaks to their sensibilities beyond just their identities and the circumstances of their lives. At the end of the day, I think the desire really is, how do we encapsulate the human experience so that we're not just focusing on Pedro's identity, but really the very things that people who don't even share his identities also actually go through.
Through the process of filming, you know, 6 years and all the editing, everything that comes with it, one of Pedro's central questions was, will all of his sacrifices and hard work pay off when he has such limited capacities, right? And now that you're in the process of showing this finished product to audiences and interacting with people, how has the process of this documentary and sharing it with others impacted Pedro after filming now?
For sure. Well, I don't know when this is going to air, but if you all are going to be around on Sunday, September 29th, Pedro will actually be there in Milwaukee to do a Q&A with me. So if anyone wants to hear Pedro's scoop on this, please join us. But I'll speak only on behalf of what I know he has communicated with me. You know, in the film, Pedro talks a lot about being unable to really consider what the future holds. And sometimes when you're in a very precarious situation, thinking about the future can be really stressful, if not maybe even traumatizing. And I think when Pedro and I first started sharing the film with the world, actually, especially because of the political climate, you know, and it's an election cycle, I think there was a lot of hesitation. And Pedro had said that if he knew how the film would be received by people and how many screenings we would have, that it would go international broadcasts and go to film festivals all over the U.S., Pedro is a very shy person, so actually he always says he would have actually never done it. Because from the very beginning, Pedro was thinking that we were going to do a small film, which is also what I thought. But then our film just kept getting momentum, and it became like this snowball effect that it became an avalanche by the end. So all this to say, in the course of the past 18 months now that we've been sharing the film, I think it's taken Pedro a lot of stress from the beginning, but now seeing how people respond to the film has been really affirming to him, I think. You know, Pedro, one time there was in a screening, an audience member who is not disabled, who is not an immigrant, approached me saying, I came here to watch your film hoping to learn about another person's experience in life. Instead, I learned more about myself. I think that kind of response has been really informative for Pedro, because now he understands the power of his story and how it becomes a catalyst for people to open up about their own vulnerabilities and open up about the experiences that they don't get to show others often. And by Pedro being vulnerable, it's providing a mirror for folks to realize, look at this person showing his most vulnerable self, even though he's not always ready for it. Maybe I can do that for myself too.
Set Hernandez is the director and producer of the documentary Unseen. It will be playing at Milwaukee Film's Dialogues Documentary Festival on Sunday, September 29th, with both Hernandez and the film's subject Pedro in attendance for a Q&A. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how obtaining a COVID-19 vaccine has evolved over time. Plus, we'll learn how the Wisconsin Historical Society collects our state's political history. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.